Okay, let's start off by just finishing up the lecture that we had. Last class, we were talking about distributions. It was basically, yeah, question. But I think what I want you to do is to give we want presentations to be on the 9th and the 11th. Okay? I have prepared, I've looked at your proposals. I want to talk with you about it. So probably catch me after class is a great time. And I'll talk to you briefly about what it is you want to do. I just want to make sure I have some people signed up to give a talk that night, on the 9th. Any questions about that? Okay? This is not meant to be an arduous, big formal thing where, you know, people need to do something, you know, too sophisticated. Okay? What I'm really looking is that we get discussions going about what you're doing and what directions you might go and where the complications are and things like that. That's what I'm more interested in than a, sort of definitive presentation on the subject.
So about how long?
I'm looking for each group to be up, standing up for about 15 minutes. Okay? I've got, let's say that that's about right. Okay? Any questions? And that will hopefully include discussion. So, So don't prepare the whole long history of what it is that is relevant. You know, of everything that is known here. Okay? Because eventually I'll kick you off. We do want to discuss what you're actually going to be doing. Okay? Because the hope is that we're going to be building models here that have some predictive value. And this is how we'll sort of make sure that we're pointing in ways that are defensible. Any questions? Okay, so my vision for today is, let me finish a couple of slides on on basically distributions, which is what we were talking about last class. Then I'm going to have a quick talk by the, about a 15-minute-ish talk, I was told, by the rapid response team on what's in our stock database. Many of the projects are going to be based on the stock database, so it's probably worth talking about. And then we're going to start talking about some methods for analyzing time series. Okay? That's the vision. Any questions? So last class, what did we do? We showed that, that it's a useful thing. Instead of modeling prices, we're better off modeling returns, sort of the deltas of the prices, or the ratios of the changes of the prices day to day, basically. A normalized return. And we wanted that to have the property that it would be, we had this vision that returns should be distributed in a bell-shaped curve, okay? But we also came up with arguments to suggest that the distribution of returns, okay, is not normal, okay? So everybody's favorite bell-shaped curve does not completely match the distribution of day-to-day returns, okay? Any questions? Okay, or I will argue any other returns. You want to use year-to-year returns, whatever you want. It's not really going to be completely captured by a normal distribution. Any questions about that? So what other distributions might we consider? Well, again, just to define, remember, we defined a return. The return for a particular day was, I believe, the price of that day over the price of the previous day minus one. Is that right? That's what we were defining the return as being. And so the idea would be that in a world where if we believe that prices are going to stay the same, the return is going to be about zero on average. Okay? And, this sort of seemed like a bell-shaped distribution. We expected losses to be about as frequent as gains, okay, although not completely. Okay? And that suggested sort of a bell-shaped curve. But normal curves didn't completely match it. One other distribution that people use a lot when they talk about stock prices is they talk about log returns, okay? And the assumption is the log return would remember be, we want to think, what is the log return, okay? It's basically going to be the log of the return, okay? Or the log of this thing. Now, what is interesting here? Well, we talked a little bit about log returns, okay? One assumption might be that log returns are normally distributed. Okay? And, again, when we went back to last week, the reasons we thought that random, that returns were not normally distributed, there were three reasons we didn't believe that. One was that the tails were not symmetric. Okay, so they both didn't go out to infinity. One was that the sum of random, you know, if we assume that that individual returns were random variables, then normal variables, then a multivariate return was going to be the product of normal variables and not normal. Now, that problem goes away when we talk about log returns. Because if log returns are normally distributed, what is the multivariate, the return over a particular period? It's the sum of the day-to-day returns. And the sum of a bunch of normal variables is apparently normal. Okay? Does that make sense to someone who knows about statistics? Okay? So that is an argument that this philosophical problem goes away when we deal with log returns. Okay, so that's a good thing. Now, the trouble still is that the third objection that we had with, with log returns was that with returns being normally distributed, is there was much more mass at the tails than we would expect, okay, from a normal variable. And that problem apparently does not go away when we talk about log returns. Okay? Any questions? So my way to think about this is the model of modeling returns as normally distributed is a good first order model, okay, but it's wrong, okay? Probably log returns, the log normal distribution, is a better model, okay, but it's still sort of wrong and incomplete. Okay? Any questions? A third model of a distribution that we might use to try to capture the distribution of returns is as a mixture of normal distributions. Okay, so what was a normal distribution? We had it was parameterized by two things. There was a mean and a standard deviation, correct? Now what happens if I consider two different distributions, one of which has a much larger standard deviation? How will that look relative to the first one? A lot flatter, meaning more mass out of the tails. Does everybody agree with that? Now, if we picture that the real distribution of the world looks like this, and the normal distribution looks like that, okay, when you fit the best normal to this thing, maybe what you could do is add to a normal distribution with the, standard deviation that best fits the observed returns. Maybe we could add a second component, make a linear combination of the two distributions, where we have most of the weight on a distribution that whose standard deviation reflects the bulk of the returns we see, plus a second distribution with a much wider standard deviation, a larger standard deviation. The claim would be that the sum of these two terms would be a distribution that looks normal to us, okay, but would have, when you add it up, we would get the effect of the extra tail support coming from the flat bell-shaped distribution, okay, and the bulk of the mass coming from our regular distribution, okay? And the claim would be that a mixture like this might better be used to predict stochastic prices. Any questions here? Okay? Yes? Okay, well, the first problem is, of course, that now this gives us more parameters to fit, right? So now instead of just finding the mean of the stocks and their returns and their standard deviation, okay, We have to somehow find two of those things. Okay? And this is not at all obvious to me how you fit. Okay? It's clear you've got twice as many parameters, it is harder to fit. You need more data to convincingly fit it, especially because the purpose of the second term is to capture the relatively rare events. Does everybody sort of get that idea? And if not, let's talk about it. But the basic problem was that the normal distribution, okay, underreported rare events relative to the observed distribution of returns. That stock market crashes and booms happen more often than would be suggested by the normal distribution. Okay? So what we could do is have, since the tails are already pretty far out, they're pretty rare events, okay? We would have to have the proportion devoted to this second normal be fairly small. Does everybody see that? If we're trying to capture the probability of rare events, the contribution of this has to be fairly small, and the standard deviation of this has to be fairly large. Okay? Now, if you're trying to fit that robustly, you need to have enough rare events in your data, okay, that you can, you know, confidently predict that. But what do we know about rare events? They're rare, right? Everybody agree with that? So it is hard to, you know, it's hard to fit this thing because in principle you need a lot of data to fit the tails of the distribution. Okay? Is that sort of clear, or are there any questions about that? Yeah, question.
So now you have a bunch of data.
Yeah.
And then you're saying
that well, you don't. Okay, that's not really what you're going to be doing. Okay, what you're going to be doing is plotting the returns or the log returns. Okay, for that you observe from a particular day, you've been from your life. Okay, or the entire time series you have, and you're going to get some kind of observed distribution, right? Does everybody agree that's what you would get? Okay, based on what you've observed. Now your question is, how do you fit this to get a prediction? You would like to get a model of what the return distribution is. Certainly, if we assume it is normal, it is easy to predict what the normal distribution is. Why? You find the mean of this thing, and that's going to tell us something about where it's centered, right? And we get the standard deviation of this thing. And that is going to give us a normal distribution. Now, the problem with that is that if we do this, it is probably the case that there is more mass outside of that. Okay? So in order to try to now fit this thing as a mixture of two distributions, okay, somehow you're going to be multiplying this original normal distribution maybe by like 0.95, and then you're going to want to add another normal distribution to it, okay, with a much wider base of support, a much larger standard deviation. And maybe that's going to be the normal distribution like this. 5% of this plus 95% of that may give you a curve that looks more like the observed returns that you've seen. That is what the argument is. Okay, yes. Well, you could also consider more than two distributions, but the more distributions you add, the more parameters you have, the harder it is to estimate this thing. Okay, does everybody sort of agree with that? And that should be clear. You're trying to add the second curve to model how often there are stock market crashes, right? Well, how often are there stock market crashes? Okay. Under Democratic administrations, very infrequently. Under Republican administrations, still rare, right? Does everybody agree with that? Yes. Well, you don't want an exact explanation. What you probably want is a model that is fairly robust, okay? Which means one with relatively few parameters that does a pretty good job, right? Now, why do we want this in the first place? Why do we care about coming up with a curve that models the probability of stock returns? Okay? So what are you going to do with this? What might we use? Suppose, let's say, I have a model that will predict the future returns for a stock. Okay? Give me what's the probability the return tomorrow will be this, that, or the other thing. Okay? I argue this would help me price what the value of an option is. Right? Does everybody agree? Should everybody sort of agree with that? If I know how to, if I know what the probability distribution of the price tomorrow or a year from now, okay, which in principle I could, it could do by looking at the returns and, you know, playing them out, you know, for 365 days. I argue that a probability like distribution like this is important for, let's say, pricing an option, okay, or trying to figure out what my level of risk is, okay. You know, what is the probability that I will be wiped out, okay, within a year if I leave my money in the stock market, okay? That, I claim, is what you would want to be able to determine by this kind of a distribution, okay? And if we just use a normal distribution, we probably get a pretty good prediction of what's going to happen tomorrow, although we're going to underreport crashes and booms. Okay? Which, if you're trying to use this to measure your risk, is a bad thing, right? If you're trying to predict the value of an option, probably the most interesting behavior is when the stock goes up much more than you think or down much more than you think, right? So that's an argument for why you would want to be able to predict probability distributions. Why the simple model isn't necessarily going to be the best one. Is it necessarily going to be adequate? Any questions? Okay? We should believe that using this mixture of distributions, okay, is going to be harder to fit. The other question is morally justifiable. Okay? It seems to me that if you want to predict what's happening in the stock market, to predict what the probability distribution of returns are, one is that you could have a first order principle model as to what they should be. Okay? We think normal returns would follow from certain assumptions about stock market behavior. You would need to now argue that there's sort of two different kinds of days, maybe. There's days when the market does normal things and days when Alan Greenspan speaks. Okay? And Alan Greenspan speaks every 20 days or something like that. Okay? I don't know. But that would be the argument that maybe for some kind of a mixture model. Okay? But to me, that's less satisfying than the idea that there was just a sort of normal distribution. The problem is it doesn't seem to work. You know, it doesn't fit observed data perfectly. Any questions? Okay? We would not want to have to represent it by the mixture of many normals. Because the more parameters you are, the more you're going to be fitting the weirdnesses of this distribution, but I would argue probably less robustly. Okay, because we're really trying to predict things you probably have very little data about. Any questions about that? So there is a business in trying to look at different distributions and trying to predict what distributions model stock prices or model stock prices out at the fringe events. Okay, and people talk about, I've seen people talk about the Cauchy distribution. They talk about stable distributions or power law distributions. I am hoping we'll talk about these kind of things a little bit later in the course, okay? Some of the other ideas of distributions that lead to, bringing sort of fractals and things like that, okay? But that's where this whole game comes in trying to, fractals and other weird things come in claiming that the distribution is not normal, it's some of these other distributions, okay? Any questions? Okay. So what do stock returns look like? Okay, and basically I've said a lot of this already. Okay, in general, they exhibit greater kurtosis, but more weight at the tails than either normal distributions or log normal distributions would suggest. Okay, so extreme events are not predicted properly. Stock returns also exhibit a certain amount of skewness, okay, which neither of the distributions we've talked about now would have. Okay, which do people think are more happen more often, stock crashes or stock booms, single day stock booms? You think booms happen more often than crashes? Okay, I wouldn't think so. Okay, I mean, somehow if I think of the, when you empirically look at things, the crashes tend to be, single day crashes tend to be deeper than the single day rebounds. Okay? But if you look at, let's say, the history of events, if you look at how much the stocks go down in the great crash of 1929, it may have dropped 20% that day. In the great crash of 1987 or so, it dropped 20%. The next day it rebounded 10%, which is an amazing jump. But the big increases are less large than the big decreases. And that's an argument that there's some skewness in this distribution, which we don't really see here. Okay? Any questions? Okay? This chart, which you probably can't see, which we'll probably talk about later in the semester, what we're going to talk about random walk models. This is sort of a chart showing how a random walk model, my master's student Greg Longo and I developed, how well it predicted stock prices 10 days from now. Okay, let me try to explain what it's actually plotting. And it exhibits a lot of the things that we're sort of seeing. Basically what we did was we had built a model that, based on random walks, tried to predict what is the probability that a stock price is going to be what 10 days from now. Okay? And so for then, 10 days from now, we looked at what was the actual price and saw what percentile of probability was it compared to our prediction. If our prediction was was perfectly right, the number of actual movements that fell into each percentile bin would be identical. Is that clear what I'm saying, or do people not understand what I'm saying? I don't understand. Okay. So suppose, let's say, that I predict that the return tomorrow is going to, 10 days from now, is going to look like this. Is the probability of a return of losing 20%, you know, 5%, 4%, 3%, and so on. When you base it 10 days from now, when I look at what the price actually did, it fell somewhere on this curve, right? Everybody agree that 10 days from now, that price corresponds to a probability. Where were we on this curve? If our prediction of what the probability of each price move was right, we would expect that if we broke it into percentile bins, the number of actual movements that fell into a bin of, let's say, the middle 10th percentile, okay, was going to be about 10% of the actual movements. Okay, does everybody sort of agree with that? So if we do a good job of predicting, we would expect that the number of movements in each percentile bin would be about what we predicted they would be, right? And if they were overrepresented or underrepresented, we would see where were they over and underrepresented. So that's what this is sort of seeing. Fortunately, we can't read it. But this is sort of showing the prediction of how many occurrences we would have in each percentile bin. They would be uniform because they were percentile bins. Then there were, if you look at it here, in the middle, there were more movements than we expected. Right? If you look at these bumps, what are these little arrows, these little terms up here? This sort of argues that movements near the mean, okay, near zero, near the median return, were more often than we predicted. Events at the extreme side were less than we predicted. That is sort of consistent with the idea that we were using a normal distribution. It's a little bit more complicated, as you'll see when we talk about the model later. But suppose we were using a normal distribution to predict the outcome of prices, movements, and the real world was something like this. What would we expect to see? We'd expect to see that we underestimated how many movements there were at extreme points, okay, and overestimated how much many movements there were at median points. And that's the kind of thing that's sort of reflected in the simulation. Any questions? Okay? So anyway, that's the argument as to why we want to predict returns, okay? Because it'll help us model other things, probabilities of returns. The distribution is not quite normal, okay? But, it's bell-shaped. Any questions? Okay, that's all I want to say about distribution. Any other questions? Okay, let's have our rapid response team talk about the database and any experiments they did on them. And then we'll continue with the new material. Go. One of your talking is a good thing, yes.
You don't want to see people
there.
That's fine.
And that's true for groups. If you want to, when you, if some of the projects are teams, if you want to have one team member give your presentation, that's fine.
Okay, so I'm going to be talking about the financial database and what exactly comprises the financial database and how one could use the financial database to calculate, or rather infer different kinds of data from the information that's in there. So the financial database is, it's actually in MySQL, and MySQL is available from mysql.com. There are binary versions for Windows and Linux, different architectures. You just download it, install it, it's very simple, and you have a very cool database up and ready running. So the financial database is just a set of files that the person has on CD-ROM, just copy into the data directory of MySQL, and you have just created a directory called finance, and put everything into it. And after MySQL has been installed, you will get a prompt if you run the MySQL binary. And you just have to say use finance, and you're ready to use the finance database. The finance database has a lot of tables in it with a lot of interesting information. I'll just talk briefly about what tables there are and what exactly they contain. There's a table of stocks, which is which contains information about all the stocks on different exchanges, and this has the stock symbol, the exchange that it is traded on, the company name, and the market capitalization. There are two other tables which give you information about the Dow Jones Index and the Standard & Poor's 500 Index. These actually have information about day-to-day movements of these indices. You have a day, the value at which it opened, the high in the day, the lowest in the day, the close, the number of shares that were traded, and you have something called the adjusted close. The adjusted close is, as Mr. Sina talked about it in class, it's actually the value of the close that has been adjusted if the company has paid out a dividend. So if the company pays a dividend, the stock price presumably drops, and they adjust the value to reflect that in some sense. Each company then...
Does the adjusted close sort of change on other days? Is it different from the close on other days or only on dividend
days? No, on different days. It generally is the same as the closing value, except on Sundays. So we have used the adjusted close for all calculations because we thought it was more accurate because it actually reflected the actual price.
But presumably that this continuity doesn't happen, and if you look at the adjusted close column, that this continuity doesn't happen the day the dividend is given out, it's the day after.
After, right. Then there's another, there are tables for each symbol that you would find here in the stocks table, and so there are there's a table for every company that's there in this table, and that table also contains information very similar to the Dow Jones and the Standard & Poor's tables, which is you have the date, the open, high, low, close, volume of shares traded, and the adjusted close. So in fact, using these three tables together, one can get information using SQL queries on various performances on various dates. There are a few other tables that are interesting. There's a dividends table which actually has information about when a company paid out a dividend. And I was just looking at the dividends information, and it actually had something like the amount that they give out on a particular day that's present in this table is actually their prediction of how much dividend they would be able to give for a complete 12-month period. Starting that day, their prediction of how much they would be able to give out for the complete year.
So the dividends records are sort of basically a stock set announces what their dividends for the year will be.
Right.
They predict the dividends. They don't actually announce what they're going to be paying on a particular day.
No. I just read this up on the finance of the Apple.com page, and they actually said something like, these are dividends. These are predictions by the company of how much they would be able to pay in a complete 12-month period as of that day. It might change. I mean, they might announce this later on after a 6-month period, so that might be different from the prediction that they had earlier. So it might either be better or worse than what
they did. So the actual dividend payment would be the difference between the adjusted close and the close that day, I guess.
The slips table has information on when stock splits occurred, which symbol, what date it occurred on, and the numerator and the denominator. So if a split is something like, the numerator is something like 1 and 2, so it would be that if a share costed $1.40 the previous day, the next day after the split, it would be multiplied by numerator divided by denominator. So one stock of 40 would be two stocks of $1.20 each. There's a balance sheet which gives information about each company's performance, an income statement, and a cash flow.
What is in the balance sheet in the income statement?
The balance sheet. Okay, I have not put the attributes of the page.
So there is documentation for the database now on the web.
On the website, yes.
Okay, so if you look at the course web page, there is going to be a link to the Rapid Response Team's web page. Okay, and they supposedly have put up the database and the
the documentation for the database.
There is complete information we put up how you would go about installing MySQL and how you copy the database and how we start using it. So, information about what tables are there, what symbols are there in each table, and how you would use the SQL query tool. Very good.
So if your project needs it, we have the copies, we have CD-ROMs with the database on it. So if you think your project is going to need to analyze either stock time series data, or it's going to have to analyze balance sheets or liabilities or things like that, that in principle we have for a large number of companies. Something on the order of, what, 5,000?
More than that. It's about 8,000.
Okay, so like 8,000 companies, you know, of which, you know, 500 count, okay? And, you know, the rest are very tiny things. Okay.
As part of what we were supposed to do, we actually had to analyze the information that was there in the finance database and write up a few Perl scripts to see how exactly some stocks perform in relation to other different stocks or in relation to the indices, for example. So the first thing that we did was we analyzed how we just took the information about the stocks in the Dow Jones Index, because that was, it had 30 companies on the Dow Jones Index. So what we did was just take the simple information from those 30 companies and just analyze how those companies perform in relation to the Dow Jones Index itself. So what we did was just calculate the correlation coefficient between the actual stock prices of the stocks themselves versus the Dow Jones Index. A further modification that we also did was instead of the raw stock prices themselves, we used the returns as was discussed in the class. And instead of only correlating the stock prices, we actually correlate the returns between the two values. So what is correlation? Correlation is just say there are two tables of information. There's values from the stock prices themselves. Say for example Microsoft. So we have information on a per day basis for the stock price of Microsoft itself. So for example, on one day it's $20 per share, the other day it's raising 30 and 10. And then the Dow Jones, on the other hand, has an index of, say, 10,000. On the other day it's 10,000. So all we do is just plot this on an X and Y axis. So this is, say, Microsoft, and this is the Dow Jones. So you just plot these points on an axis, and we analyze how well you could model this with a line. So the correlation coefficient actually calculates how closely these lines give you a pattern. So for example, if all lines fell on a straight line, the correlation coefficient would be 1. So basically it just calculates the slope. And if the stocks, if the values form a line with a slope of -1, the correlation coefficient would be -1. And if just absolute random data, correlation coefficient would be 0. So this is just a formula for calculating the Pearson's correlation coefficient. And that's just about it. The X and the Y are just any table could be X and any table could be Y. So the information here. Input the tables are important against each other. Yes. I just explained how a little bit about how you can use the in order to use Perl to query the database, you need to use a package called API. And this is available from cbang.org. And
you just install the package and you're ready to query the MySQL database. And Perl has a wide variety of inbuilt statistical methods and things, lots of things that you could use to analyze information. Although the correlation was something that we just quoted in because it was pretty simple. But there are a lot of stat package that you could use, which gives you a lot of extra interesting functions that you could use in order to analyze the data that's there in the database. Some of the things that we did was, as I talked about, calculating correlation between stock prices and the major indexes. There was another thing that we did was, which was rank the stocks on various measures like percentage of stocks traded. So this was something like one of the tables, if you remember, has a volume traded on that particular day. So the percentage of stocks traded was just simply the volume, the percentage of stocks traded on that particular day for that simple. Versus the number of outstanding shares for that company, which could be calculated from the market capitalization, which is also present in the database. And another thing we did was calculate the pairwise correlation between stocks. So instead of calculating the correlation between the stock and the index, we just calculated the pairwise correlation between one stock and every other stock. So
I have a few results here. So these are the results from the first experiment, which is calculating the correlation coefficient of these companies versus the performance of the Dow Jones itself. So as you can see, there's not too much of a correlation as I might see. Some stocks have a much better correlation coefficient. For example, Johnson & Johnson in this decade performed much better compared to the other companies, and it probably had a better contribution towards the Dow Jones.
You're saying that the were you preparing? Okay, this looks surprisingly low to me. It looks like all the correlations are extremely low.
These are the returns correlated.
Correlated against what?
The index itself.
Oh, but okay, that there's your problem now. So you should be presumably correlating the returns, the returns of the day-to-day returns, presumably, against the day-to-day returns on the Dow Index.
Right, the day-to-day returns on the Dow.
You are doing that? That is what you're doing?
Yes.
Isn't that somehow
the beta of the stock? Why is the beta of the stock? It's how it does. Right.
So,
well, it's a little bit, we haven't talked about beta in here. But it's sort of, beta is a measure of how much does the stock move relative to the market's movement. That's a little bit different here. This is a question of whether the direction of the movement, in some sense, is akin to the direction of the Dow Jones, of the Dow Jones average. Okay? So I would argue I'm surprised that these numbers are very low. Okay? And that's why
we actually take this even against Excel actually has a provision of calculating the correlation coefficient. So we fed in the returns of the stock as well as the Dow Jones, and it actually came out of something.
You
make
perfectly
advice,
advice, and finding the different parts.
There were two tables, right? One was returns from, say, one symbol, which had performance in a decade, say 71 to 80. So there was one column which had returns for that stock in that decade. There was another column which had the returns of the Dow Jones index for that decade. And these two were plotted on.
Were those daily returns?
Yes.
Okay, I do not believe that those numbers should be so low. Okay? That's sort of, that's one thing that we probably should talk about offline. Okay? So I would have expected that the correlation between the way the index moves and each company moves is probably quite high. I would have guessed that, you know, it would be on the order of, you know, 0.5, 0.7, something like this, that it would be highly correlated with what the index actually did. And you're now showing correlations that are, I mean, we'll talk about the properties of correlations right after this, but basically the correlations I see are very small, and in many cases, sometimes even negative, okay? Which says that in a typical day that the Dow goes up, okay, American Express is going to go down. And that I find surprising, okay? It's true when Alan Greenspan speaks, he speaks to everybody, okay? Right.
So it's okay if it's like five times the price of American Express, but two times the price of Microsoft. And if this time Microsoft goes up by 100%, the American Express drops a little bit, that kind of doubt produces 5X+. Why?
Well, it certainly can, but I would still expect, if I look at this thing, I would expect that they would be the largest component of the Dow, which really must be more than 3% of the Dow. You've got 30 stocks, you know, that's an argument. I would argue that you would expect to see a high correlation, okay, higher correlation to this, okay? So I'm a little bit suspicious of these numbers, okay? We'll talk about that. I'm not trying to jump on here. But this is actually an argument that says that you have to think a little bit about what your numbers are when they come out. I mean, tell me if you agree with me versus disagree with me. This is acceptable. We're having a vote here. So it's not you're not being tested on this.
I think, like, if you did it, like, maybe monthly, my clarity would be a lot more. Like, I don't know, maybe daily would be better.
Okay.
So those are these are the companies of the Dow.
20
companies
on
the Dow.
What? Well, all the companies on the Dow are fairly big. I mean, you know, they're all companies you've heard of. You know, Coca-Cola. The only one you haven't is Altria, probably. Anyone know what Altria is? Right, it changed its name. It's, you know, sort of, it's a stealth company. It's a tobacco company. So Altria used to be Philip Morris, as I understand it. Okay, and so they're sort of trying to hide. It's really fun. Otherwise, you know everybody there. Okay, or almost everybody there. Okay, so these are big companies.
This is Walmart and Walt Disney. The printer refused to go.
Okay, but we'll take a look at that. But I don't personally believe that. You have to convince me of that. Okay, so let's keep going. I may be wrong. Okay.
I'm not sure. What is the point of saying that you don't have to like
that? Okay, there's a question. First of all, I may be wrong. So if I'm wrong, we'll find out. Okay. I would have expected that the correlation between an index and the individual stocks would be fairly high. Because in general, when you have a good day for stocks, almost everybody goes up, right? And when you have a bad day for stocks, almost everybody goes down, okay?
And again, as you said, it depends on the composition of the
Well, if let's say the Dow Jones average was all bought out by Microsoft, 100% Microsoft, you would expect no correlation, little correlation against everybody else, but 100% correlation against Microsoft, and everybody's number there is small. Okay, we'll talk about that. Let's talk about that. Okay, but I may be wrong, but I'm suspicious with my immediate sense. Okay.
Index, I think,
he's saying is that the Dow index, this is, these companies against the Dow, it doesn't mean that these companies are present in the Dow.
So you actually saw a blank.
You're talking that you did some.
You saw blanks, right? You saw blanks in.
There was, you know, this Microsoft, for example,
the companies
didn't exist against the Dow.
Didn't exist. So, yeah, so there's no information about that here.
So when those 30 companies were
right. Right.
But I would still have expected that there's a correlation between how companies are doing on a particular day and how the index is doing on a particular day. If there was no correlation, why do we bother talking about an index? Sort of my argument here. Now maybe we're using it on the wrong scale. Okay, like you're saying that the bearing it over a year doesn't, you know. But I'm suspicious. Okay, and so we should look at that.
And if the companies keep moving in and out of that 4%, I don't know how much sense you can think to do it over a decade, because I've seen a lot of companies here, like Microsoft and Kickstarter, and ExxonMobil are two different companies.
I would argue it still makes sense. Let's say that we take half the people in this room, okay, and we throw you out of the room, okay? And I think I measure the happiness of the people that are left, okay? I would argue that the happiness of the people that are in the room, maybe in response to the weather or something like that, is going to be the same as the happiness of the people outside the room. So if you measure the happiness of the people that are in, if it's a representative sample in any way of the world, it would reflect the people who are out. So I don't think that is the issue. I don't think the issue is about has something to do with composition of the Dow. Okay.
Correlation of that stock compared to the Dow. So the effective period that you can study the correlation say that it should be high. These 2 years, because in fact it was not part of the Dow. So I don't think you're justified in saying that you should have a strong correlation with the Dow.
We talked about two different kinds of risks. There's one that is specific to the company, and there's one that is unspecific. And we sort of believe that sort of unspecific risk captures a lot about, okay, what the price of the stock is, you know, when Alan Greenspan makes a speech, et cetera. And that I would still think would be what you would expect to see measured by correlating stocks against the index. Okay? So we'll have to talk about that. But I mean, we'll have to see. Maybe I'm wrong, okay, or maybe you're wrong. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay, an index is some function of the individual stock. You have a set of stocks. You have some function formula that is computed on the prices of those individual stocks. Well, the Dow is some formula. The S&P 500 is another formula. The Sheena index, okay, which I've been defined by, sort of the stocks that I own, okay, would be another index. It's not very representative, okay, sure. Okay. So an index is just a set of stocks and how it does. And for an index to be meaningful, we would like to think that it's capturing in some statement something about a larger market. Okay? And that doesn't seem to be the case from what you're showing me here. But maybe if some so we'll talk about it. But that's why I'm suspicious. But maybe I'm wrong. Okay.
These are the results from
pairwise
correlations between companies.
Over how long a period of time?
This is last month.
The last month. Okay. So over a month, what you're seeing now are much higher values of correlation than before. Okay? So these are big numbers. These are numbers I wanted to see somehow. And let's see if they pass any kind of sniff test. What companies would we expect would be highly correlated?
HTC and AT&T are very important.
Which two?
HTC and AT&T, both of them are in same communications.
So HTC and AT&T, what number is that?
HTC is this one?
Yeah. T. So what is the number there?
HTC and
okay, so that says that that those industries show similar rates.
We can even consider the high volume.
Okay, so do we have
BA and Honeywell?
Okay, so Honeywell, I think, sells electronics for aviation or something like that.
No, it builds aerospace systems.
Aerospace systems.
For Boeing. Display systems.
Okay. So presumably what's good for the aviation industry is good for both. What's negatively correlated? Who's the most negatively correlated?
Procter & Gamble is not really correlated very much for the companies.
Okay. I know.
3M is not highly correlated.
3M and say Procter & Gamble are less strongly correlated than another one.
I have a negative 6 here. 3M and
3M and Caterpillar.
Caterpillar.
Again, if it's only over a month, that is a difference between somebody going up and somebody going down. So I'm not sure that, if we had think of two companies which would be, in principle, negatively correlated. Like, let's just look. What of companies might be, in principle, negatively correlated? What? You would say competitors. I would argue that probably they're actually going to be highly correlated. Because you would expect that they're in the same business. If suddenly people are buying a lot of cars, it's good for GM and it's good for Ford.
Companies in different industries.
Companies that are in. So you would expect that in totally different industries you would have, there probably are some companies we can think of who deliberately should have negatively correlated things. Whenever something is good for one of them, it's bad for the other. Okay? Can we think of any? I mean, there must be something of that type. What? Right, so let's say you have a company that likes bankruptcy, okay, that somehow profits from bankruptcy, okay, another company that profits from the economy getting better. You would expect them to be negatively correlated, right? Because when everybody else is happy, the bankruptcy company is sad, okay? But, I would expect there to be strong positive correlations between companies in similar industries. Probably a few weird cases where it should be negative. But I still think that because you're only thinking over a month, it's really sort of local news that is sort of affected. So if this was a good month for most companies, okay, a company that sort of did something bad, okay, would get hurt. Okay, so we'll take a look at that. So we have to see why that isn't for a longer period of time. Would be that if you want to pick a diversified portfolio, this is something that we were sort of arguing, you should be picking stocks such between them have relatively low correlations, right? I mean, we said Boeing and Honeywell had a correlation of 0.8 something or other, okay? Or if both of them, if that really held true over one call, they would be, you know, you would, you know, if something was bad for one of the companies, it would probably be bad for both of them. Okay, so that's an argument that for diversity, you would want low correlations. For some of the other things we're studying in the study, it is like pair trading models, you'd probably want high correlations. Okay? And so these correlation charts are important for some of these products, and you have to figure out how to do them right. That's the moral thing. Any questions?
All these results are there on the web.
So. Okay, so let's talk afterwards if we can. Anything else to say? Okay. So
hopefully the project presentation, you know, the little project reviews will provoke certain amounts of comments. That's sort of what we're kind of hoping to have.
Okay. Any questions about that?
Okay. So you and okay. So what I would like to talk about now is correlation and covariance. Okay. So now I would like us to start talking a little bit about, you know, time series analysis. Okay, we've seen that that you know, analyzing different time series is going to be a useful thing to do. Okay, and doing it right and thinking about what the meaning of it is an important thing to do. I'd like to talk a little bit about correlation and related issues. I think maybe today I'll talk about correlation and related issues, and then talk about. Hopefully we can get far enough to cover that today before I talk about other classes of models. We say that that when we talk about two pairs of random variables, okay, we talk that there's the covariance function of two random variables, okay, is going to be the expectation of over all possible values that pairs of values the random variables can take on. Of what is the difference of the first random variable from the mean times the difference of the second random variable times the mean. Okay? And what the argument here is the following. Okay? That if you have two random variables which are sort of in sync, okay, that one of them is high when the other one is high, and one of them is low when the other one is low. Okay? The covariance is going to be high. Let's think about random variables of height and weight. Okay, if we sum them up over all people, do we think that they are fairly well correlated? Okay, we would argue that that's true. Well, why will height and weight give us a high score for covariance? Okay, if those are the two random variables? Over each person we expose it to. If somebody's weight is greater than the average weight, it is likely that their height is also greater than the average height, right? So that would be an argument that a positive term times a positive term is a positive term, right? If both of them are negative, okay, if you have a lightweight, a small light person, this is going to be negative, that's going to be negative. Negative times negative is positive, right? So positive contributions come when you're on both on the same side of the mean. Negative contributions come when you're on different sides of the mean. Okay? So there are two things that are negatively correlated. What might be negatively correlated? Let's say probably age and wealth, right? Supposedly. Okay, the older you are, the richer you are. Well, no, it's positive. They're both positively correlated. What would be, what would be two variables that are negatively correlated? Sort of think about that. Age and fitness. If you measure fitness, it says you have age and wealth, age and health. Okay? If we plot it that way, okay, as, you know, every time the healthier person is going to be young. Okay? So, most of the terms, if they're a young person, this is going to be negative, but their health will be positive, that's going to be negative. Okay? If an old person, their health is going to be negative, but their age is going to be positive, that's going to be negative. If there was no correlation between the two of them, somehow you would expect that each of the values are equally likely to be on either side of the mean. Okay? And if that's true, these terms are going to cancel themselves out. And that's sort of a hand-waving argument, that a big number for covariance means correlated, low high negative number means negatively correlated, zero means sort of independent. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay? We're going to be interested in, and so the correlation coefficient, which we talk about, okay, is basically, again, the formula, when you see it in a book for a sample, it's basically computing this thing as the sum of, for every point, computing the difference between the two, summing them up and averaging, okay, dividing that by the square root of the variance of the two variables. The correlation coefficient is defined as the covariance over the square root of the product of the variances. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay, when you go to any statistics book, you will see that the magical properties of this is that it somehow normalizes it so that this value always lies between minus 1 and 1. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay? We're going to be particularly interested in correlations of series with themselves. Okay? And those are going to be called you can kind of think about a function. You can define the correlation, the covariance or correlation of a sequence with itself. Okay? And what does that mean? Suppose we have a time series, okay, at a particular point, x1, x2, x3, x4, and we correlate it with a leg of 1. That means we want to know what's the correlation between the first term and the second term and the third term, dot, dot, dot. Okay? And that's what we talk about, sort of leg covariance or correlation issue. Okay? We'll talk more about that in a minute. Any questions? Now, what do high correlations mean? Okay? The important thing to know is, in general, a correlation is a measure of how in sync the two variables are. Correlation does not imply causation. Okay? My favorite example has to do with the Super Bowl and the stock market. Okay? If you read, there's sort of a well-known relationship, which depending upon, again, in the Super Bowl, many of you may not be familiar with the Super Bowl, it comes in the basic principles of the Super Bowl, are that there are two football teams that play each other. And one of them represents the AFC and one of them represents the NFC. And someone has noticed that when one of the conferences wins, the stock market goes up that year. Okay? When the other conference wins, the stock market goes down that year. And since the Super Bowl happens in January, this is would be a good predictor if there was a causal relationship there. Does everybody agree with that? Now, the trouble is that I don't see any causal relationship here. Okay? Does everybody sort of believe that, right? But it's somehow, when you look at it, there's been like 40 Super Bowls or something like that. And something like 80% of the time this predicts the outcome of the stock market, right? Okay? So that is a high correlation. On the other hand, it doesn't imply a causal relationship. Okay? And so one sin that we have to be careful of if we're going to try to, let's say, predict markets or correlate certain things, is wildly taking many pairs of variables and correlating them. By chance, you're going to get some of them as with high correlations. Okay? And so a bad thing to do, somehow we want to develop a system for picking the stock market or whatever it is. A bad approach is probably to try to use a pure data mining approach where you correlate many things and see what happens. Because unless there is a reason for a correlation, a causal relationship, okay, it is likely that the correlation will go away the moment you bet on it. Okay? Any questions about that? That should be believable. In fact, how do you measure the strength of a correlation? How much you believe it? It should depend upon how many points, how long the time series is that you correlate. The longer the time series is, the more a strong correlation means. Okay? That should be clear. Okay? By the number of pairs tested, depending upon how you found this correlation, should tell you something about it. If you had this one insight, gee, I think this is related to that, and you saw there was a high correlation, that has meaning. If you try 100, you know, 1,000 pairs of things and see what happens, and you get a high correlation, you should be suspicious. Now you should see if there's a issue of a sniff test, okay, should there be a correlation? And finally, if you're really into this, there are statistical tests, okay, that's really the right way to do this, okay, it would be some kind of a statistical test based on the number of pairs and, you know, and stuff like that. Any questions? Okay? But this kind of infer cause, you can't really infer causation and correlation, but you can presumably infer when it's likely not to be meaningful. Any questions?
Okay. Let's see if I can end it there. What, a particularly interesting issue in correlation is what we will call the autocorrelation. Okay, this gets back at what we were sort of hinting at before.
A Legel autocorrelation is the correlation coefficient between a, let's say, a return series and a return series lagging by L terms. Okay? Any questions? Now, we in principle can get a correlation for every lag. Does everybody agree with that? There is a lag 1 correlation, there is a lag 2 correlation, dot, 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 up until n terms. If you've got n terms, there's a lag n correlation, autocorrelation, correct? There's even a lag 0 correlate, autocorrelation. You can correlate a sequence with itself. And, you know, but that presumably is going to be 1. Okay? Any questions here? The more interesting thing here is that any linear time series, okay, is in principle somehow characterized by this autocorrelation function. Okay? So, to a certain extent, if you take the time series, you can construct this vector of autocorrelations. And that is going to basically encode, okay, what the nature of the time series is. Okay? Any questions about that? Yeah. What? When is a correlation zero? Okay, a correlation should be zero when there is no significance, no meaning, let's say, to the difference between the original and lagged thing. Okay, so what would be an example of a series that we would expect the autocorrelation function to be zeros? All zeros. Okay, or close to zero. What? Not stock, give me some sort of, suppose I give you a bunch of random numbers. Okay? If we take the autocorrelation of a bunch of random numbers, I argue that we would not expect any correlation between the random numbers and the random numbers shifted by 1. Does everybody agree with that? Okay? Or shifted by 2, or shifted by 3. Okay? Now, certain functions, I claim, will, the autocorrelation function, we would expect to have certain properties. What would you expect the autocorrelation function of stock returns to be? Okay, if I give you the stock returns for a particular stock, 3M, 3M yesterday, day, dot, 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 dot. If we have a particular lag of 1, what would be the level of correlation, autocorrelation, you would expect? You're saying slightly greater than 0 for a lag of 1. Now, why is that? What is that intuition? I'm not sure whether it's right or wrong. Any other people's intuition?
I'm saying lag is 0.
What?
I'm saying it's close to 0.
You would say close to 0. He's saying close to 0, but positive for a lag of 1. What about a lag of 2, 3, 4? What do we think is going to happen if we get further out? You say it's going to go about to 0. What is the argument here? If we really believe that stock prices are going to be independent, returns really are randomly, it's sort of a, you know, white noise type random variable, where there's no predictability of it, yesterday's return tells you very little about, should tell you nothing about today's return, right? That would be the argument that the lag one quarter relation should be zero, right? On the other hand, we probably don't completely believe that, right? At least in our hearts. I mean, somehow we sort of believe that if the stock market went up yesterday, probably it's slightly going to go up, more likely to go up tomorrow, right? Okay, if so, that's the argument that it may be a little bit positive. Okay, and I believe that that's basically true. But at least philosophically, I think that's what we think the order of correlation function should be like. What if we consider stock market volatility? How much is jumping around, okay? In a particular, you know, volatility is measuring how active is it, jumping around, okay, in a particular day. What do you expect to be highly correlated? Do you think that if the stock market is highly volatile today, it is likely to be highly volatile tomorrow? Do we believe that? Okay, I think I sort of believe that. Okay, I mean, somehow, if, you know, when Bin Laden, you know, crashed into the World Trade Center, obviously the world was very volatile then for a long time, right? And when, you know, when Bush invaded Iraq, okay, the world was quite an upheaval. Now maybe we're in a relatively quiet mode compared to a while before, right? But so we would sort of expect that the volatility today is probably a good predictor for the volatility tomorrow. Okay, so we would probably expect autocorrelations, significant autocorrelations for short lags, right? And probably that correlation is going to decrease the longer the lag is. Everybody sort of agree with that? That the shock of a world event is going to sort of decay with time. Any questions? One last one. Let's just take a look at this thing. What about sales for Walmart? Okay? Suppose I have a time series representing sales for Walmart. What do we expect? Let's say I have monthly sales for Walmart here. What do we expect the autocorrelation function for that to look like? Do you think that today's sales are probably going to be highly correlated with yesterday's sales? And that I think I believe. Are there any other lags that are likely to be significant? Seasonal things. What would we expect? Do we expect that if today is, let's say, December 24th? Do we think that the sales for December 24th this year are going to be fairly well correlated with the sales for December 24th last year? I think the answer is yes, right? So we certainly would expect that there is going to be some kind of a cycle here, okay, which should be picked up by the autocorrelation function, right? We probably would expect a seasonal thing, okay? What other cycles might we expect in the Walmart sales? Business cycle, okay, it could be that there's sort of, you know, business cycle has to do with worldwide depressions and things like this, okay? That somehow that there are good times in the world and there are bad times in the world, okay? And that there's somehow a gross time scale to this thing. And you would expect that sales are going to go up when times are good and go down when times are bad, okay? Any other cycles that we would expect in the Walmart data?
What about seasonal weather?
Well, okay, so weather effects probably show up as, for the most part, well, there's seasonal effects in general, okay, which probably mean, you know, which are governed by Christmas and governed by weather, okay? There's probably some other effects, like if there's a rainstorm today, probably it means it's going to rain in a couple days, too. Okay, any questions? Okay, look at this, someone ready to rain on my parade. Okay, let me get out of here then. Okay, so next class, so let's go outside if you want to talk about your projects. We'll talk about this, continue talking about correlation or autocorrelation next class. Okay, thank you.